This is an ABC podcast.
Well, if you've ever missed out on a job due to what you thought was a bit of a jobs for the boys kind of culture, you might be keen to hear about this inquiry that's going on in New South Wales, where today the star witness took the stand.
I will say this, if I knew what I know now, I wish I never had applied. If I knew what I knew now, I wouldn't have walked into what was a shit show. And I'm going to use those terms, I'm sorry to say, because the trauma I've gone through over the last 6-7 weeks has been significant.
Well, pardon John Barilaro's French there. He is traumatised after all. You're with Andy Park. This is RN Drive. Great to be with you again. In a moment, you'll find out more about what was and wasn't revealed during the former New South Wales Deputy Premier's time on the stand today. And you're in big trouble. Big, big trouble. You haven't been to the dentist for a long time, for too long. Record levels of people have used the pandemic as a, look, in my opinion, a pretty good excuse to skip their checkup, and it's leading to all sorts of health problems. In fact, there's a new kind of surprising understanding about how big a role your teeth play in your overall health. And when you consider all the sort of crazy extreme things you might do for your health, maybe going to the dentist is not that painful after all. That's coming up. Also later, the Ukraine ambassador to Australia will join me. He's furious at Amnesty International for their new report, which accuses Ukrainian fighters of sheltering near civilians. And a little bit later on to the Victorian Gold Rush town, where you can buy the whole kit and caboodle. Even the cute pub is included. Why are they selling? Who's buying? You'll find out later on RN Drive. You can be part of the conversation. Text to share your thoughts with the nation, 0418226576. You can tweet using @RNDrive. And if you're listening via the ABC Listen app, hit the call and text in button across Australia. You're with Andy Park. This is RN Drive. First up, as expected, the federal government is supporting a pay increase for aged care workers, arguing the value of their work is significantly higher than current wages reflect. You'd know that too if you have someone, a loved one, who's in care like I do right now. Those workers are worth their weight in gold. In its submission to the Fair Work Commission, the federal government has also promised to fund whatever pay rise they recommended. The unions are calling for a 25% increase to Australia's 200,000 residential and home care workers who earn on average less than $25 an hour. Mark Sewell is the CEO of Warrigal Care Aged Care Services. He's also a voluntary director of Aged Care Services Australia. Welcome to you, Mark. I mean, hearing the government is going to fund whatever pay rise commission the commission decides must be a huge relief. But how significant are those current shortfalls in terms of staffing levels?
Oh, they're pretty significant, Andy. I think most human service industries or frontline industries are struggling for staff, but you can't, if you're an aged care operator, turn off the lights and close the shop for 5 days while you get your staffing system back on track. You've actually got to run 24/7 services. So many rosters are short rostered. Many operators are paying agency fees for staffing. So this is a great relief that this will eventually be turned around.
What, I mean, are employers' positions when it comes to the commission, do you think? I mean, they sat through the Aged Care Royal Commission. They've had multiple opportunities to sort of understand workers' complaints and concerns, certainly through EA and EBA processes. I mean, how do you think employers are taking this news?
Well, in fact, employers, and I'm one of them, have actually supported the union's cases and claims. We've appeared before the commission. I personally have given evidence in witness statements and in the box. Some of my managers have as well, to argue that aged care staff do need increases, and we've tried to help the commission understand what it takes to be an aged care worker. And this is not just for aged care workers, this is for their supervisors, their team leaders, their managers, the nurses who work in aged care. So we are fully behind this. In fact, the Royal Commission only dreamed of having the government, employers and the unions all on the same page, and we now have that. So this is a great move forward.
Yeah, the sort of furious agreement over this is something to behold. Certainly doesn't happen in any every industry every day. I mean, 25% pay rise, I mean, That's what the unions are calling for. Is it realistic? What sort of increases are you anticipating?
Yeah, we're thinking it might be something like that. The employers have always benchmarked aged care frontline staff with disability service frontline staff, and the gap is about 20%, 18 to 22% in some jurisdictions. The difference between nurses, aged care nurses, and hospital nurses is also significant, about 10 or 11% difference. And we've always thought that there should be parity between disability workers for aged care workers and hospital nurses for aged care nurses. So we expect this to be a pretty big catch-up. And this is not just about parity or equalising the salaries. This is a fair value work case. So what is the fair payment for the tasks? So what are the value of aged care staff to the customers, to the community, to the government? That's what the commission will do now for the next 12 months, assess all those submissions and make a determination.
You're listening to Andy Park. This is RN Drive. Mark Sewell is here. We're talking about aged care workers and this potential pay rise that's certainly seemingly more on the cards as the submissions to the Fair Work Commission continue. Increasing the pay of aged care workers was, we all remember, one of the key recommendations of the Royal Commission into aged care. But is it going to be enough to stop the lack of care, the poor quality and the abuse, the poor quality food, for example, the abuse that we all just generally heard about and know about if we have loved ones in those situations? Is this the kind of silver bullet to all those problems in the aged care sector?
No, there's not one silver bullet. There's 148 recommendations made by the Royal Commission. The government of the day accepted most of them, I think 140. The new government has said that it probably will accept most of them as well. It's already on a plan to roll many of them out. So there's not just the pay increases, because good people join aged care not because of the money. They're not doing it for the status of the career. They're doing it because they like working with aged care, older people. But this is part of the problem. And so fixing this problem will be good. The other thing is staffing levels. So there are recommendations in the Royal Commission report about increase the staffing levels and the rosters, put more nurses in on 24/7 basis, put more carers in, put physiotherapists and allied health staff in. So those things have got to be rolled out as well as all other things like a star rating system for the public to understand which providers are the best operators, and being able to compare them as a buyer or a chooser for parents or grandparents. So all those systems come together. But boy, if the whole sector is full of staff underpaid, it certainly doesn't help. And so we're delighted this is a big plank in solving the problem.
25% increase is not going to find workers, is it? Or will it? Do you think it will become more of a competitive option for people who do have qualifications that are applicable across the aged care services sector?
Yes, I think it will. I think there'll be people who would gladly work in aged care services coming out of hospital or coming out of disability services. If people got paid more to do their hospitality and customer service skills in an aged care service, might come out of retailing or hospitality or hotels or tourism. All those sectors aren't fun to work in either. All those sectors have ups and downs by the pandemic and other economic factors. Aged care is very stable. Very big teams, lots of great equipment, lots of great people, very appreciative families, and has got a growth career trajectory going on for 10 or 20 years. I think many people would be attracted to it if it was paid well.
Mark Sewell is the CEO of Warrigal Care. Appreciate your time tonight, Mark.
Okay, thanks, Andy.
He's also a voluntary director of Aged Care Services Australia here on RN Drive. Coming up, time to confess. How long has it been since you've been to the dentist? You thought I was going to say the priest, didn't you? No, the dentist. Your dental appointments have been certainly a casualty of the pandemic. Apparently one third of people have skipped a checkup, and it's leading to all sorts of surprising consequences for your health that you may not know about. That's coming up. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Andy Park. It's 14 minutes past six. It's the job which former New South Wales Deputy Premier John Barilaro regrets submitting his resume for.
But I was confident that the process was so clean, so independent, that my selection could be easily, anyone could stand against the selection. And today I sit here today going, and I used words earlier today, and disappointed that it hasn't been as clean as it should have been. And I'm the victim out of that. I'm not the perpetrator.
Yeah. So the political drama resumes as the New South Wales Parliamentary Inquiry continues its examination of Mr. John Barilaro's appointment to a Plum Trade Commissioner role based in New York City. Alexandra Smith is the state political editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. Welcome to you, Alexandra. Obviously, there's plenty to unpack here, given all the talk about speaking to colleagues, either applying and then pulling out and then reapplying. Do we know that Mr. Barilaro wanted this job to begin with? Did he ever expressly ask that of the Premier? Have we heard that?
Well, no. I mean, I think what we got a sense from John Barilaro that he was undecided about a lot of things, including when he would leave politics. He made it clear that at some point towards the very end of last year in Sydney's Martin Place, he ran into the Premier and mentioned that he was interested possibly in the trade role. But he was at pains to stress that it wasn't a long-held goal of his.
The Premier apparently said great as a response. That's according to his testimony.
Yeah. John Barilaro said the response that he got from Dominic Perrottet was great, go for it. He also revealed, the first time we'd heard this actually, that he'd also mentioned it to the Treasurer, Matt Keane, who gave a similar sort of, response, go for it. So he clearly had been at least putting the feelers out with some interesting, all Liberals, given he was the Nationals leader. And he said that none of them raised any kind of political red flags. None of them could see the problems coming. I mean, I'm sure absolutely none of them foreshadowed the fact that this drama would bubble along for sort of 7 or 8 weeks now and completely consume the New South Wales government.
I want to play another exchange involving Mr. Barilaro. This is his testimony today.
But if we had to believe your version of events, Mr. Barilaro, we have to basically conclude that you're one of the luckiest men in New South Wales politics.
Well, no, actually the unluckiest man in New South Wales politics, I'd argue.
So Mr. Barilaro has said he's been traumatised by this. He says he's the victim, not the perpetrator, and that he's one of the unluckiest men in New South Wales politics. What did you make of these kinds of appeals to the panel?
Well, I mean, I think for anybody who has followed New South Wales politics at the time when John Barilaro featured very prominently, you know, that sort of language and that kind of description of himself would not have come as any surprise. I mean, in his mind, he has been completely hard done by because he believes he applied for the role, got it on merit, and then had to fall on his sword for the sake of his former colleagues because it was creating such heat in the government. But of course, you know, we've already seen that things are, he said himself, the process wasn't as clean. And of course, you know, just last week, the Trade Minister, Stuart Ayres, was forced to resign after it emerged that it looks as though his involvement was much closer than he let on. And the Premier had to do that very awkward statement just days after coming back from a big Asian trade mission with the Trade Minister and reveal that he had to step down from the role. So I think, you know, while John Barilaro might say he's the unluckiest man in New South Wales politics, a lot of people would have seen this coming, particularly as the weeks have rolled on and, you know, this scandal's just gathered more and more pace. More people are being pulled into it.
Yeah, including former New South Wales Premier Barry O'Farrell. I think he was one of the referees for Mr. Barilaro's job. There was this other revelation this afternoon that Mr. Barilaro's girlfriend was working at Investment New South Wales at the time the job was advertised, although she'd finished her contract before Barilaro applied for the role. I mean, there's all these sort of links, if you like, and obviously Mookie and the others who are interrogating the witnesses are trying to sort of develop these links a little bit more. How are they relevant to the inquiry, though?
Well, I think it all goes down to a broader picture of these. There are six trade commissioner positions that the government set up, and it goes to whether the government's process for handing out these positions was, you know, transparent, open, you know, all above board. And what we've seen, so obviously this inquiry was about John Barilaro's appointment, but it has now, the terms of reference have been expanded to include another one, the London-based one, which is known as the Agent General's position. So what we're sort of seeing from these links that you spoke of, Labor's Daniel Mulkey putting them all together, is they're trying to paint a picture that there's a wider problem with these trade appointments. Perhaps it's not just restricted to how John Barilaro secured the New York job. Labor and the opposition are definitely trying to pursue a line that there is a broad problem with these positions that the government introduced only last year.
On RN Drive, Alexandra Smith is the state political editor for the Sydney Morning Herald. She's breaking down the political drama of John Barilaro, the former New South Wales Deputy Premier, giving evidence at a parliamentary inquiry into his appointment to a plum trade role in New York City. Of course, it would be a mistake, Alexandra, to sort of write this off as, you know, anything to do with just muckiness in New South Wales politics, because if there's one thing this whole saga is starting to make the average person realise, is just how these processes happen, whether they be states that have these jobs in great cities like New York or London that you probably didn't really know about. But it's a bit of a lesson for any government as a result of this inquiry about what not to do, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I think we'll probably get a bigger, clearer understanding when the independent, so there's two inquiries underway, the parliamentary inquiry, which we've spoken about, which John Barilaro appeared before, but also another one that the Premier had to instigate, that's an independent inquiry, and it's looking at the processes around how these jobs were given out to people. And I think when that report, which is due any day now, is handed down, I think it's going to be quite an eye-opener, because these are new positions, and I, you know, perhaps the problems are confined just to these roles, it does, to me anyway, and I'm sure many others, raise concerns about how other positions are potentially being handed out within the government. And I think, regardless of what comes out of that inquiry or the parliamentary inquiry, it's going to be very hard for the New South Wales government to shake this perception of jobs for the boys, or at least jobs for mates, because, you know, everywhere we've turned, like I was saying just earlier, this scandal, this saga has got a little bit more murkier. It's brought someone else in, and so it's becoming a really big issue for New South Wales, and it's managed to completely dominate all discussion now for the best part of 2 months, which is extraordinary. I haven't really seen anything. I mean, even when we had a premier last year go down because she was in a secret relationship with a corrupt man, didn't sort of take up this much oxygen.
Yeah, that was rather painless when you think about it. This is really drawn out and sometimes quite operatic. I'm just curious about how long it's going to... I mean, you must be talking amongst your colleagues in the State Parliament Gallery about how much further this has to run before it does sort of tarnish the Premier of New South Wales, who's not long into this job.
No, that's right. So he only took over once Gladys Berejiklian resigned. The problem is it's still got a long way to run because, as I said, we've still got that independent inquiry to hand down its report. There's still the parliamentary inquiry. Stuart Ayres, who was the former trade minister, is also now subject of a separate inquiry to see whether he breached the ministerial code of conduct during his position and his role in these appointments of these trade commissioners. Then, of course, you know, not only have you got this coming, everybody is still waiting for the Independent Commission Against Corruption report into Gladys Berejiklian. So there's a lot of pain that the government could potentially still have to face about this issue, but also others. And, of course, in New South Wales, there's less than 8 months or so to the next election, which... I mean, of course, they say a week's a long time in politics, but 8 months will come around very quickly, and there's still a lot of issues facing the government. Of course, ones they haven't even known may pop up. So it's going to be a very rocky road from here, I think, for Dominic Perrottet.
Yes, well, if only I'd known that this is what people do. You kind of sort out your next job before you quit. This is news to me. I think I've been doing my career wrong, Alexandra. I think I've got to work out my next job before I quit this one. And I'll leave you to go back to your job. Thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you, Alexandra.
Thank you. See you later.
Alexandra Smith is the state political editor of the Sydney Morning Herald there. Very interesting revelations coming out of the New South Wales inquiry into the appointment of John Barilaro to that New York trade job. Lots of you jumping in on the text line, 0418226576. This one says, I am the victim. Well, now I've heard it all. JB says, Barilaro is just another politician who attempted to engineer a cosy income post-retirement. The only thing he's apologising for is being caught out and attempting deception. And appreciate every one of your texts. I see them all. 0418226576. You're with Andy Park here on RN Drive. It's 25 minutes past six, and coming up, we're going to be crossing to the Commonwealth Games closing ceremony. Of course, it kicks off tomorrow morning. It's been a big games, lots of off-field dramas or off-pool deck dramas, you might say. But Australia has become the first country to win 1,000 gold medals. Sounds like something like pirate treasure, doesn't it? That's coming up here on RN Drive. Yes, well, it's the sporting event apart from Aussie Rules, which Australia dominates in, don't they? Geez, it's incredible how many medals we've won at this Birmingham Commonwealth Games, perhaps best exemplified by our colours of green, now partnered with that 1,000 Commonwealth gold medals. Early tomorrow morning, the curtain comes down on Birmingham 2022. Mel McLaughlin has been helping beam back the sound and the pictures that you've seen of all the sporting action on the Seven Network in the past 12 days or so. She joins me now from Birmingham. Mel, you must be exhausted.
Oh, hi, this is Pip, actually. She's just on air at the moment, so we've just got a couple of seconds, just one read.
Okay, so we're treading water. We're going to tread water just like
the... You can hear her now in the background.
The water polo players must play. So, yes, Pip, you work with Mel. It's obviously very long hours.
I do. Here she is right now.
She's so busy that she can't even do her own live crosses. This is the sort of commitment that Mel brings to the stage. Mel, you must be so tired. You've even got Pip doing your work for you.
No, Pip is amazing. I just threw her the phone. I said, I just need 20 seconds. I'm so sorry. Just threw it to the break. We're tired and we are so happy. We've had the best time. And I think the whole group of us on the road have... we've been to Tokyo, we've been to Beijing, you know, the summer, the Winter Olympics in bubbles. They were both amazing experiences, but, you know, COVID bubbles, it was really weird to travel. There was no one around, you couldn't do anything. So it was really strange here at first where, you know, you wanted to go into a shop, you just could, or a restaurant, you just could. And, you know, you're not wearing masks to interview people, you know, you're not, you know, 10 metres away. And, yeah, and we don't have extreme weather because Tokyo was the hottest Olympics. Beijing was minus 30 to 35, and here it's just beautiful day. So, and it's just been amazing. Birmingham's amazing. You know, the whole event's been great, and the English, they just know how to do it.
Yeah, it's amazing when you've had the experiences that you've had in terms of comparing the games, whether they be Olympic or Commonwealth, and just to see the massive organisation that goes on behind the scenes. We don't really see that on the TV, do we? Whereas you do. You're walking the corridors behind the scenes of all these events. The kind of, it's just enormous, really, the palaver behind a games as big as these ones.
Yeah. And obviously the added layer was COVID, and so we get to see even from Channel 7, we've got some pretty amazing people that work from a long way out to get things ready, and it's, you know, been unbelievably stressful for them just trying to get us through, get us into the countries in the first place. And, you know, to put on these massive events and, you know, landing in Tokyo, you needed 50,000 pieces of, you know, paperwork, you're getting tested then and there. You know, Beijing was the same. And then I thought I'd done something wrong. I panicked at the airport because I just had my passport and I was ringing people going, are you sure? I just need my passport. Do you know what I mean? Just that, and that's all we needed. But and then so basically to coordinate all of us, and, you know, they end up being the parents and we're all allegedly grown-ups, but you end up, you know, feeling like the kids, you know, having no idea. But yeah, you know, in terms of, you know, getting our team over to these places, you're right, it is a massive deal. And we've got, you know what, we do have Laundry Gate at the moment because, and this is a really
laundry
big issue. Laundry Gate, this is, you know, really serious, mm-hmm. you know, lots of people putting in their washing, and then a photo goes out in the group chat, you know, who's socks are these? There's like four different, you know, single, you know, and you know, people are just panicking and just hoping Bruce McAvaney is not on that list because we have to make sure that he's fine and that, you know, that who's got the black sock, who's got the floral socks, and then you get mocked if they are yours. So
he would be quite specific about his socks, Bruce McAvaney, I'm sure. You wouldn't want to take that man's lucky socks. Let's move to the action on the field and in the pool. I mean, in terms of the Australian success, I mean, it's a never-ending kind of reel of highlights, isn't it? What's been the moment that you've been witness to that really kind of makes the top grade for you moment?
I just, well, for, I guess the moment for all of us was Ollie Hoare and just how emotional that was, how I say what a surprise it was for all of us. But, you know, we mentioned Bruce. He, you know, had to pick one to watch and he had Ollie from a mile off. But, you know, that was history made. He gave such a beautiful interview and then he joined us on our show, our award-winning, there's no award for the Brum Drum, but we're just telling everyone there is. He came on there as well with Bruce and they had another moment as well. So that was a really, really special time. Even last night, the netball, I was so excited from, you know, it's been 4 years. We've been desperate to see the Aussies get that gold medal back. You mentioned 1,000 gold medals. Well, they, you know, won the 1,000th gold medal last night. So that was incredible and lots of the girls in tears. So there's been so many moments and obviously in the pool, which feels like years ago and obviously it wasn't. But, yeah, Ollie Hoare was number one. For sure. But, yeah, there's been some very special moments.
Of course, Ollie Hoare joined the legendary Herb Elliott as the only Australians to win the Commonwealth 1500-metre race. Mm-hmm. Pretty special moment there. Sports journalist and presenter Mel McLaughlin from Channel 7 is here. We're talking about the wrap-up, really, for the Commonwealth Games. The big finale will happen tomorrow morning Australian time. The opening ceremony really showed flew the flag, so to speak, for diversity and inclusion. How do you wrap up the games after that sort of opener?
Oh, well, you know, they've done such a great job, as you said, the opening ceremony, which, you know, these things can go either way, but it was brilliant. I'm actually standing at the stadium right now and I'm watching all these, well, looking at the track, which is being transformed with all these people, you know, wearing hard hats at the moment. They're building the stage right now. As you say, you know, they paid homage to so many different things. There was that bull that's become a cult hero. That's a terrifying thing in real life, but, you know, attracts massive crowds now. The Peaky Blinders, you know, you've got the flat caps everywhere and we played dress-ups ourselves with that. But, you know, they're doing... We're expecting a big, you know, a concert, a big party tonight. And as we say, they know how to do it. We know, you know, Victoria's got the next... Commonwealth Games,
yeah.
And Vanessa Amorossi is going to perform.
Okay, yep. So there's a bit of a chain, a bit of a link to what the next one was, because I was just thinking your next Commonwealth Games coverage, you won't need a passport at all, will you?
No, well, let's never assume, because I've been locked in a few different places due to borders and whatever, and I'm, you know, fingers crossed that, you know, things will be normal. So, yeah, we can just wander to Victoria, which sounds good to me, but, yeah, they've been putting on great parties every single day. This one's going to be enormous.
Well, Mel, enjoy it. I'm sure you'll probably sleep for days after this. Appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you, and thanks for having Pip as well. She's a legend.
And
one.
Thank you to Pip. Behind a good reporter, there's always an excellent producer. Sports journalist and presenter Mel McLaughlin from the 7 Network there. On RN Drive, you're listening to Andy Park. Coming up, you're going to hear about Australia's very own Schitt's Creek if you're a fan of the US network TV show where a whole town can be purchased, including the shop. Well, this one includes the pub, and it could be yours. Find out how much for the town in rural Victoria. That's coming up here on RN Drive. It's 26 minutes to 7.
The newest, boldest, funniest, most compelling writers from Australia and around the world.
I wanted to be taken into another world for next to nothing. All our books came from the library, the Osborne Park Library. It was a hell of a drive.
Catch up on all the action from RN's big weekend of books while the ink's still wet.
You just know that a certain section of the community is not going to enjoy your very existence and there's not much to be done about that.
It's all waiting for you under the big weekend of books tab on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to RN Drive. Time for some real talk. Time for some honesty. Time for some confessions, perhaps. Have you been to the dentist recently? Because I'm going to make a wager you probably have been putting it off because of, well, the whole COVID thing and also who loves going to the dentist. Perhaps it's the increased food and heating bills taking priority over your trip to the dentist. Yeah, nice one. Use that one as well, why don't you? Of course, dentists are concerned that we're becoming at risk of being a nation of rotten teeth, like the Brits. More Australians are putting off going to the dentist. A survey by the Australian Dental Association recently revealed that more than a third of people had postponed dental treatments since the beginning of the pandemic. And don't take heart in that. Don't say, well, everyone else is not doing it, so why do I have to do it? Why are you putting off going to the dentist? Maybe it is because of those factors. Maybe it's because you're making use of those factors, like pandemic excuse. Perhaps you've been recently and you got a bit of an unwelcome surprise. This text says, I went to the dentist in June, but it's going to cost over $2,500 after four more appointments. See, that's the thing. If you put it off, they tend to get more and more pricey as you go. I'd love to hear from you. Have you been to the dentist lately? Are you putting it off? Are you pretending to put it off because, well, it was all the pandemic, really, and you didn't want to go and get COVID in the chair? Like a wuss. 0418226576 is the text line. You can tweet me too at RN Drive. Dr. Matt Hopcroft is the CEO of the Australian Dental Association's Victorian branch. Matt, just how many people are putting off going to the dentist? I think it's a third in your survey. But what are the excuses and are they at all valid?
Yeah, great talking to you, Andy, and thanks for having such a really important issue to talk about, because this is something we've been concerned about since the pandemic started. And I think your point about, you know, people being concerned about getting COVID in the chair was a real concern at the start of the pandemic. But what we've seen over the last 2 years is it is very safe to go to the dentist. We've got very high levels of infection control, and we haven't seen that bit play out. But people are concerned. Our survey showed, you know, a lot of people not going. Something like 2/3 of Australians haven't been to the dentist in the last 12 months. And when we think, you know, go to the dentist once a year, that's a lot of people that are missing out on a really important part of their overall healthcare, and you know, something that's really concerning.
Matt, I'm one of these people. I just have to just spit it out now. I haven't been.
I wasn't going to ask you.
No. Look, you're well within your rights to ask. I think it has been probably 2 years, and I love going to the dentist. It's not like I've got a lovely dentist. They're very gentle and they're not like really crazy expensive. So there's no reason for me not to. It's just fallen off the agenda with all the other things that are going on. I'm just wondering, because there is this new understanding, if you like, about how dental health and oral health is linked to all these other parts of our health. What are we neglecting by not making that appointment to go and see the dentist?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question, Andy, and it's something that we talk about a lot. You know, the mouth is the gateway to the body, and good oral health, or good health starts with good oral health. So it's more than just having a nice smile and you know, good-looking teeth, but it's about how well you can eat, and nutrition's really important. But there are links between gum disease and cardiovascular disease, or gum disease and diabetes, for example. So we think that it's really important that good oral health fits within that context of your overall health, so, and that's why we want people to prioritise.
So if it is such a priority, as you say, why are there such long queues for Medicare-related dental procedures? Why isn't it such a priority from a federal health perspective?
Yeah, and this is something that we've been talking about a lot with the federal government and, you know, with our state government counterparts as well. So here in Victoria, for example, our waiting lists for public dental care are now up to 26 months. And the pandemic's had a part to play in that, but it's mostly due to just a lack of funding. And, you know, historically, dentistry has sat out of Medicare, so there's not a lot of Commonwealth funding. We talked in the federal election about a pensioner or a senior dental benefits scheme that the Royal Commission recommended. It's really pleasing to hear the Greens talking about those sorts of things as well. And we're looking forward to working constructively with this new government to see if we can't start to introduce some more funding to help. You know, there's millions of Australians who are missing out on necessary dental care because it's not funded in the way that the rest of healthcare is funded.
In fact, the Green Senator David Shoebridge recently tweeted that he'd received a message from someone who'd been forced to rip out a fractured tooth with pliers because she couldn't afford to go to the dentist. I mean, this seems like pretty extreme examples of what people are increasingly struggling to deal with. What sort of things have you seen anecdotally when it comes to people delaying and trying to avoid the cost of dental care in your practice?
I mean, fortunately, I haven't seen those sorts of examples myself, but I hear those stories from colleagues all around Australia all of the time of people having to resort to, you know, doing something like taking a tooth out because they're, you know, they're isolated perhaps, or they can't afford care. And so it's really important, and I want to try and encourage people, go early and prevent some of these problems from becoming bigger problems. And, you know, we know that cost is a concern for people, but problems can get much worse when you delay care as well.
Matt Hopcraft is here. We're talking about your teeth and how important they are. Windows to the what did you say, Matt? They are the windows to your health.
Yeah, well, the mouth is part of the body, and good health starts with good oral health.
I like it. Someone on the text line says teeth are the tips of the iceberg. Wondering if you've been putting off going to the dentist. Lots of people owning up on the text line, Matt. Lots of very honest confessions. I think it's because I said I haven't been, and so people are like, okay, well, you know, I'm not a bad person. I just need to go to the dentist. What about when it comes to the cost? What can you advise people on trying to mitigate the cost of dental care? How can they support access apart from private health insurance?
And look, two parts to that question, I guess. And the first part is around prevention. So the more that you can do to prevent problems, the more money that you're going to save. So things like eating really well, reducing the amount of sugar, brushing your teeth twice a day with fluoridated toothpaste, flossing in between teeth, and going to the dentist regularly to get checkups, all of those things will minimise the risk of problems. If you do need to go, if you do have dental treatment that you need to pay for, I mean, private health insurance can help, but it's not often in many cases the sort of thing that really effectively helps to cover the cost of dental care. But if you're concerned about the cost, speak to your dentist, because our dentists out there, they want to make sure that you have as good oral health as you can. If it's been 2 years since you've been, that's okay. There's no judgment from our side. We just want you to come in and we'll work with you to try and make sure that we can help you to get back to a good level of oral health.
Lots of people on the text line, as well as admitting to their lack of dental appointments in the last 2 years, are raising that question that we sort of talked about a little bit, which is the non-inclusion of dental care in Medicare. This one texter says dentists have fought for decades against any moves to become part of Medicare. Is there any truth to that?
So originally, we go back to the foundation of Medicare decades ago. There was concern from the dental profession back then, but there was also significant concern from the government that they didn't want to include dentistry either. And so historically, there's some reasons why. But we fought hard as a profession when a previous government tried to scrap a Medicare-funded program for kids. And so we've now got a very well-established child dental benefits scheme for kids that has $1,026, I think it is now, of care over 2 years, funded in either the public sector or the private sector. And we've gone, as I said, to the last election, campaigning for a similar scheme for older Australians. And we think that there's real value in the government doing that and gradually building up that Medicare coverage for people who desperately need to seek care. So it's not something that the profession opposes. And we've been very active in calling for that over the last few years.
Another text says, if I represented an employer group such as dentists, I'd launch an inquiry in an attempt to reverse the declining income. Is it a case of declining income? I mean, certainly in the last 2 years with the sort of, waylaid appointments, should we call them, being kind, is that affecting the business model of dentists, or is it something bigger?
Look, I mean, the pandemic certainly had a huge impact on our industry, as it has on every industry out there. And depending on where people are in Australia, here in Victoria, really significantly impacted by lockdowns. And we're fortunate, as a lot of other industries were, to have both state and federal government support to kind of help us through that situation. But it's not a matter of the pandemic influencing the way that people are are practicing now. I mean, I think people are just really, dentists are really keen to get their patients back to look after their health because, you know, at the forefront of our mind always, as health professionals, as all our health professionals are out there, knowing how tough it's been for everyone. And, you know, I can appreciate why people have put off going to the dentist for the past 2 years because it's been a very tough past 2 years. And so it's just about, you know, how do we help people to come back and prioritise that one aspect of their health that we're experts in and that we think is really important in the way that the rest of the health profession is out there, making sure that, you know, you're fit and healthy in other ways.
So, Matt, I've been very honest with you about when I last went to the dentist. Time for you to be honest as well. I'm not going to ask you the last time you went to the dentist because that would be stupid. You just go to work every day. But I was going to ask you, what do you tell someone who's nervous and scared about going to the dentist? Is there a secret kind of thing to tell them to calm them down?
There's not a secret thing because for everyone, anxiety is a little bit different. And, you know, dental anxiety is a really big barrier to a lot of people going and seeking care. And for some of them, it's a bad childhood experience. For others, it's different reasons, you know, fear of needles, fear of other sorts of things. And so it's about just talking to patients and trying to understand where that anxiety and where that fear comes from and helping them work their way through that. And, you know, again, just encouraging people that if that's a barrier for you, be really upfront with your dentist because, you know, we know that people can be very anxious, can be very scared about coming. Have that conversation so that the dentist is very aware of that. And we're really keen to help you to work through that as best we can so that that doesn't impact on your oral health.
All right, Dr. Matt, I think I'm going to have to come and see you on Thursday. You got some room in the morning about 10:30?
I could probably squeeze you in at about 10:30, Andy.
Excellent. You might need about 3 hours just to get through all the muck. Dr. Matt Hopcraft is the CEO of the Australian Dental Association's Victorian branch. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Andy. Great talking.
Lots of you on the text chiming in about why is dental treatment not more included in our federal subsidised healthcare scheme. This one says apparently in Ireland you get one checkup and one clean per year on Medicare. This one too, we helped a relative and her kids get the treatment they needed. No way could they afford it. There should be funding to make sure dental treatment is available to everyone. This one on the cost as well. Why do dentists charge like medical specialists? It costs something like $300 to get my last appointment done. Well, I suppose they're highly specialised, really. And you don't want them to slip, do you? You want a good dentist. I think Dr. Matt was a good dentist. I think I'll see him. Thanks so much for your text, 0418-226-576. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Andy Park. It's 12 minutes to 7.
Lend us your ears and experience a world of audio content with ABC Listen.
A world of sound.
Like the new pop culture podcast, Schmeichgeist, decoding the biggest trends this year.
I saw a trend happening on TikTok, basically, I've never seen before.
Trash reality TV. It is my favourite thing in the world.
And for the kids, Dynadome.
T-Rex is ahead. Check out those lunges.
The ABC Listen app.
Lend me your ears.
Download it now from your app store.
On RN Drive, let me ask you, where are you right now? Are you in your car? Are you battling the traffic? Perhaps you're at home, begrudgingly listening to your loud neighbours over the back fence. Maybe you're one of the lucky ones tucked up in your cosy home, ready to watch tree change shows like Move Into the Country and dream of the day you can escape town life for a quieter existence. Well, picture this. You open a door, and as you walk through the door, you're immediately transported to a rural location where the air is crisp and clean. You're surrounded by a luscious green landscape and you see a turquoise blue stream bubbling away in the background. No busy streets, no loud neighbours over the back fence. In fact, there's no neighbours inside at all. Sounds like a misanthrope's dream place. Sounds like the place of your dreams. This is very real. And it's very spectacular too. Coopers Creek is a rural town in Victoria. It's about 2.5 hours from Melbourne and you can buy it. It's up for sale. The whole town is up for sale for the price of between the price of a 2 or 3 bedroom home in many Australian cities. The whole town even got its own pub. Ian Mason is the selling agent and Karen is from the family who's selling the property. Welcome to you, Ian. Welcome to you, Karen.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I've seen pics of this property. It looks absolutely breathtaking. It's hard to believe you can buy a whole town, Ian. Where exactly is this promised land of Cooper's Creek and what does it consist of? What is on the chattels of sale?
So it's located just below Walhalla. A lot of people know the historic town of Walhalla and have been there on the train and down the mine. So it's just on the below that on the Thompson River. So the property consists of 21 titles, 11 acres, the pub, a two-bedroom home. The Cooper's Creek flows through the middle of the property. You come through the state park and you come down to this valley and it just sort of opens up like the promised land. It's really really quite spectacular.
It does sound amazing. Karen, this town has been owned by your family since the early 1960s, I believe. How did it come into your family?
Well, the story goes that Dad and Mum were down that way and needed somewhere to stay and there wasn't anything available and somebody suggested to go to the Cooper's Creek, the Copper Mine Hotel. So they went down there and got a room for the night and Dad got up the next day and decided that he'd purchase it.
Wow, must have been a big night in the pub.
In the future. So it wasn't like the next day, but he purchased the property. And, that's how the story goes. And we spent every school holidays, weekends down there for many years, maybe being free-range children in a way. There was lots of folk bands that went down there, bush bands, family, friends. It was always a hive of activity with lots of people staying at the hotel, in very sort of rustic surroundings. There was no power, so everything was done on an open fire or a fire outside. Meals were prepared that way. But we just had a fantastic life down there on our holidays and weekends.
It's a former gold rush town. Did you ever pull any gold out of the Cooper Creek?
Oh, we all tried to have a little bit of panning in the river, but I think it was only minimal little speckles that we ever found when we were kids. You know, it was just the excitement of maybe trying to find some gold that we, had in our imagination of what it would be like. So
you never lived there yourself. It was more of like a holiday destination. Yes. So how did it come to be the whole town, though? I mean, on the list of sale here, there's 21 different lots. So how did your father come to sort of buy them all?
He just gradually bought them all and then after the pub burnt down in the 90s, my brother then decided in a few years later that he would rebuild the hotel, the Copper Mine Hotel, and so he built it back to scale. He cleared the blackberries and the bushes around the creeks and made this sort of pristine valley and he bought more blocks of land and so eventually they owned all the blocks of land.
It's the sort of place that you can imagine as a film set. Was there ever any TV or film production? I mean, the inside of the pub is really gorgeous today.
Yes.
It's very cosy, very warm. I can't imagine that you'd be knocking back offers for film and TV crews to make, period pieces in this little town.
Yes, I'm not sure what the future holds, but that's a possibility of what could eventuate down there. I mean, your imagination's your own down there. It's just the most pristine area. Your heart skips a beat as you drive down into the valley and it opens up into this beautiful place.
Sounds very special. Special enough to keep? Sadly not. It looks like it's on the market. Real estate agent Ian Mason and the vendor for this little town, Karen, here. We're talking about this picturesque town of Cooper's Creek in rural Victoria that Karen's family are selling. So who's the buyer for something like this, Ian? I mean, what sort of person has been making inquiries?
It's such a diverse range of people that have been inquiring. So there's people that are just saying, hey, I want this valley for myself and I can afford to have this like the family have got it at the moment, as just their getaway. There's been private schools contact me. There's been people who have restaurants in Melbourne that have been looking for to set up a showpiece in the countryside. There's people that have camped down there in the past and just have fond memories and are trying to put together groups of people. We've got people getting their in their private helicopter down to come down and have a look. We've got locals down there that have been waiting for it to come up for sale, I think, since 1960, that are talking to me. So it is such a diverse range of people.
Have you ever heard in your time as a real estate agent a whole town being for sale like this, especially in such good nick? I mean, sometimes I've heard stories in sort of outback Queensland, failed little mining towns that are pretty run down and ordinary. But have you ever heard about a town in such good nick as this one going for sale as one job lot?
No, not at all. And it's just amazing that the family walked in my door and said, can you help me sort this out? And I'm very privileged to be having the job to do it.
Wow. So, Karen, are you ready to let go? I mean, 60 years in the family, that's going to be a bit of a tough day.
Yeah, it is going to be very, very hard. But there comes a time where, things just have to move on, and I hope people will create new memories down there, like beautiful memories like we all have. We can always hold on to our memories, and we can always drive down there and sit around the hotel and have those memories coming back to us the wonderful memories we've had down there.
Are you worried that someone will buy it and split it up?
That hasn't actually entered my head, so I haven't really thought about that part of it.
Because certainly you'd be, considering the importance in your family, I mean, the best case scenario would be someone friendly and willing to let you come back to visit on holidays. But there is that fear, isn't there, that they could split it up?
Oh, yeah, they could. Anything's a possibility. But, yeah, it'd be nice if they didn't. But if that happens, that happens. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Ian, how much? How much do you want for it? I'll go to the bank now. Just tell me how much. I'll write the check. I mean, considering the cost of a house in any of the capital cities in Australia, the price guide for this is surprisingly affordable, I've got to say.
So we're quoting $2.5 to $3 million. We actually don't know what it's worth. So there's nothing comparable. And we're going for a process. We do have some offers on the table at the moment, and we're expecting some further offers in. So if you ask me this question in a week's time, I might be able to tell you what a town is worth.
I reckon it'll give Sovereign Hill a run for its money. You should sell tickets and like school experiences. I mean, that's it's a bit of history you've got there, and hopefully the next person keeps it intact and looks after it, as I'm sure they will, Karen. Good luck with the sale.
Thanks very much for that.
And good luck to you, Ian. Well, $2 to $3 million. You fancy yourself as an owner of a little town. Look, given the house prices in Sydney and Melbourne, I think you could probably go, including a pub. It's probably worth it. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Andy Park. And all the stories and interviews you've heard, plus many more you might have missed, such as the fascinating chat I had with a travel writer and author for the New York Times and National Geographic and others. His name's Anthony Hamm, and he had this amazing journey up the Amazon River to document the fight overland in his new book, which is called The Man Who Loved Pink Dolphins. It's on the RN Drive website right now, or you can check it out on the ABC Listen app. Lots of you chiming in with your texts on, your excuses, shall we say, why you haven't been to the dentist in some time. Lots of pandemic blaming, that's for sure. Why is dental care an industry? It used to be a profession, says one texter. That's a good point. This one too. Hi, Andy. This is from Lynn. She says, I'm on a single income, so budgeting is important. However, I have a lovely dental team who allow me to pay a set amount fortnightly. This is how I managed to afford and have access to regular dental care, my own private health cover, she says. This one too, having lost all my teeth, I'm glad to have seen the last of them, knowing the grave menace that tooth infections pose to one's general health, especially cardiac. This one too, on my chat with the owner and vendor and sales agent for the town of Coopers Creek in Victoria, who are the traditional owners of Coopers Creek. That should be part of the conversation as Victoria works towards a treaty. Very good point. It's coming up to news time here on ABCRN. After the news, the Ukrainian ambassador joins me to talk about his government being pretty mad with Amnesty International over claims Ukraine's fighters are sheltering civilians. That's coming up after the news here on ABCRN. News time, 7 o'clock. Welcome back. This is RN Drive. I'm Andy Park. Ukraine's ambassador to Australia will join me in just a moment. But coming up in the drawing room tonight, we're headed to the beautiful jungles of Palawan, the final frontier of the Philippines, where a small group of passionate land defenders are putting their lives at risk to prevent illegal logging. It's been flagged as one of the most dangerous places in the world where they do their work, and 13 of them have been murdered whilst doing it. A new documentary introduces us to the people and the land, and director Carl Malakunas will be joining me in the drawing room in 10 minutes' time. On air, online and on the ABC Listen app, you're listening to RN Drive across Australia. I'm Andy Park. Well, the Ukrainian government has accused human rights organisation Amnesty International of fake neutrality and delivering a propaganda gift to Russia over its latest report into the war. In the report, Amnesty criticised the presence of Ukrainian troops in residential areas, saying it puts civilians' lives at risk. The head of Amnesty's Kyiv office has resigned, saying she doesn't support the report. Amnesty International stands by its findings, but says it regrets any distress and anger triggered by the report. Well, Vasyl Miroshnichenko is Ukraine's ambassador to Australia. This report, and Amnesty says the report says it in no way justifies Russia's violations or invasion of Ukraine, rather its analysis on some of Ukraine's military tactics. Do you accept that this is an impartial international human rights organisation and Amnesty needs to assess every case on its merits, regardless of who is the aggressor?
Look, I understand the how Amnesty International or similar human rights organisations work. They have played an important role in protecting the human rights of many of the prisoners of conscience, and going back to the Soviet times when we had many dissidents in jails, and in gulags, and they were fighting for those people. However, you know, there is always a nuance which is extremely important, and I think this time Amnesty International has made a mistake in the fact that the way and the timing of the report and the way they've done the research for the report and also the whole, you know, communication around that has been a mistake, and actually has done a great deal of damage to the reputation of the organization. I think it just derailed their reputation. And it's not only because it was not well received in Ukraine. I think it was heavily criticized globally in the UK, US, Canada, and all the free world who have really criticized that. I mean, I've read many critical reports from different parts of from different countries. So it's not only that we don't like it as Ukrainians for obvious reasons, is that the only reason Ukrainian civilians are under threat is that Russians have invaded Ukraine and they are taking over Ukraine and we're defending ourselves. And as a result, civilians are suffering. And it's not that Ukrainian military is deliberately using the civilian spots to fire, that the whole idea and the premise is wrong, right? Because Russians are taking over Ukrainian cities. So in order to defend the Ukrainian cities, Ukrainian armed forces have to be based in those cities to be able to defend them, correct? So I think the whole premise of that research was misleading and was wrong from the very beginning of how you actually structure the research and how it's done. That's I mean, from what I've read and how I understood it, yeah.
So let's get into some more detail. In the report, Amnesty says that in 19 of the towns and villages it visited, it found instances where Ukrainian forces had located themselves right next to where civilians were living, potentially putting civilians at risk from incoming Russian fire. Granted, Your Excellency, your country has been invaded by a foreign power, and naturally you are defending your homeland. However, are you concerned at all that in the defence of your country that civilians' lives have been placed at risk in the act of defence?
Look, civilians' lives are at risk at the times of war. Russian troops executed over 2,000 civilians outside of Kyiv, and they were based there for over a month, committing heinous crimes. And they just killed those people because they were Ukrainians. They raped, they murdered, they burned them down. They just executed those people. So naturally, when Russians are invading Ukrainian cities, civilians are at risk. But the only reason Ukrainian civilians are at risk is because Russian troops are coming. You see, the whole report is wrong in that respect. It's not the issue that they should have been probably focusing on right now. The issue is different. How can we prevent from the Russian war crimes happening? Because these are more serious violations of human rights. What about Ukrainian prisoners of war, which were captured at Azov steel mill and which were guaranteed, you know, security and lives? Those people were executed on camera. One man got his testicles cut with a knife. It was on camera. It was recorded. It was shown on YouTube. And then those people were blown up in that jail 10 days ago. What about that? I mean, it's not about, you know, diverting the attention to that, but I think doing a report on civilians being harmed, they're harmed because Russians are invading Ukraine. Mm-hmm. You know, you see, I mean, that's the whole idea of that report was just wrong. And that's the reason why Ukrainian Office of Transparency International has resigned. And that's why I believe the Secretary General of the Transparency International should resign, because she's done so much damage by, you know, taking leadership on that report. Of course, I understand that they have to be impartial, but I think the timing, the research, the topic, and everything else has actually fed into the Kremlin narrative. The only government which is so excited about this report is the Russian government. Don't you find it wrong?
So let me ask you the next logical question, if what you're saying is true, is what would the motivations of Amnesty International be to side with Russia, as you've outlined?
Look, I mean, it's not that they've done it intentionally, probably. I mean, it just happened to be unintentionally. But if you have read, for instance, the position of the Times, a British newspaper, on this particular report, they're referring to a peace-loving leader, an activist from 1945, who actually would not accept, from London, would not accept that actually Nazi Germany have been executing Jews all during the Second World War. And her argument was that, well, that's the Allied forces are trying to distract attention from actually bombing civilians in the German cities. That's a very good reference and example that the Times has made, because she could not accept or believe the fact that there could have been a Holocaust. And the only reason there are reports in the British media about that is because somebody is trying to divert attention from bombing the cities of Germany while, you know, at the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, okay.
So maybe Amnesty International is also oblivious in their mission, or they don't understand what is going on in Ukraine. And maybe that's a problem.
Okay. I do want to move on, Ambassador, on RN Drive. You're listening to Andy Park, and Vasyl Miroshnichenko is here. He's the Ukraine's ambassador to Australia. I want to ask you about the situation at the nuclear power plant, which was shelled over the weekend. Do you know who was responsible for this incident? Russia has pointed the finger at Ukrainian forces.
Look, Russians are terrorizing Ukraine at different scales. And actually what is happening there near the nuclear power station, which is the largest power station in Europe, is part of their nuclear terrorism. They have specifically shelled the areas around the nuclear power plant. One of the reactors is now cut off from, you know, power supply, and they are endangering the security of Europe. Because if a missile hits that nuclear power plant, and that's the largest one in Europe, the living of Eastern Europe will be impossible. The whole area, not only Ukraine, that, you know, all Eastern Europe is going to be contaminated, because this is it's only one reactor which blew up in Chernobyl in 1986. We are talking about six operating large reactors now in the Narhodar.
The UN is asking that international atomic energy inspectors be allowed into the site. Who can facilitate this? Because I understand that Ukraine is still operating this power plant.
Well, we have Ukrainian engineers, but they are now under the Russian occupation. So it's all run by the Russians now. So it's only the Russians who have to actually provide access to the UN and Mahatet to actually being able to inspect it.
Just turning to another matter now, Latvia's foreign minister is currently in Australia and has echoed President Zelensky's call for Russia to be designated as a state sponsor of terrorism over ongoing war crimes in your country of Ukraine. What would such a designation achieve in your view?
Well, it would actually allow many countries to apply different legislation with respect to Russia. I mean, that would actually, especially in the US, but also in other countries. And I think Latvia was one of the first countries which has already considered or maybe have already designated Russia as a terrorist state, because it would make Russia a pariah state. It would make Russia join the ranks of North Korea. And this is where it deserves to be.
Your Excellency, I appreciate your time tonight. Strength to you and to your people.
Thanks. Thank you very much for having me.
That's Ukraine's ambassador to Australia, Vasil Moroshnichenko, here on RN Drive. You're with Andy Park as we slip now into the drawing room.
Drawing room over here.
You made it. Oh, come on through.
Do you fancy drink? What's your tipple?
Welcome to the drawing room, a space for intimate and surprising conversations. I'm Andy Park. Seen from the outside, the archipelago of Palawan, part of the Philippines, is a place of extraordinary natural beauty, remarkable forests and pristine beaches. But Delicado, the new documentary by Carl Malacunas, exposes a darker truth, a province that is described as eating itself up from the inside. The movie follows a small band of land defenders who risk their lives to confront and arrest the illegal loggers who are clearing those beautiful forests. And Carl is my guest here in the drawing room. Welcome to you, Carl. Come on in. Take a seat.
Hi, Andy. Thanks very much. Great to be here.
How did you come across this story? You originally thought you were going to do a sort of a light story on a tourist hotspot, and then it turned out to be far from the truth.
Correct, yeah. This was back in 2011. I'm a journalist also by trade, and I was based in Manila as the bureau chief for Agence France-Presse, AFP. And I was going to just go head down to Palawan to do a nice soft story on ecotourism. But the environmental campaigner, who was my contact for the story, was shot in the head and killed a few days before I was about to go down. So I went down to investigate his murder and instead. And while I was there, I met all these other land defenders who were putting their lives on the line trying to stop this sort of paradise from being destroyed. And I certainly didn't know about that, and not a lot of other people knew about this. People just knew about Palawan as this beautiful holiday destination and its status as the last frontier of the Philippines, because it's home to the last great rainforests. And also it's just such a biological hotspot. Its waters are known as part of the Amazon of the seas.
So by way of explaining for people who haven't been there just how beautiful a place it is, I've had the privilege of being there myself. You know, it's a 500-kilometre long sliver of land that lies to the west or southwest of the Philippines. It's close to the Spratly Islands and really hosts an extraordinary level of biodiversity, doesn't it?
It really does. Yeah, it's known as the last frontier of the Philippines for a reason. And the rainforests just incredible, just spectacular. The trees are so big you can, you know, you go through, you know, stand alongside some of them and you're putting your arms outstretched and you're not even getting you know, your hands around the sides of the trees. It's with that rainforest, there's, you know, the biodiversity through on land, and it's you know, it's limestone cliffs and its beaches are just spectacular.
Tell me about the group of defenders here. Who is Attorney Bob Chan, and why did he create the PNNI?
When I first went down there in 2011, there was one particular land defender out of all that sort of that stood out, and that was Bobby Chan. And that was because he had this tree made of chainsaws out the front of his office. The PNNI is an NGO. So out in the front of the NGO, there's this tree made of chainsaws, and it said, "Stop illegal logging." And so I asked Bobby, you know, what's all this about? And he told these stories about how his men would go into the forest, hike into the forest in flip-flops, in basketball shorts and singlets, hike for days and on the hunt for illegal loggers. And when they found the illegal loggers, they used the citizens' arrest law of the Philippines, not actually to arrest the people themselves, but to confiscate the chainsaws. This was Bobby's form of swift action, is what he called it, because he felt that the only way to protect these the forest is to stop it at the source, is to pull out the chainsaws, and also to make a statement to the rest of the people in Palawan, the community members who live amongst these areas where there's such a culture of fear and impunity. Palawan is an incredibly dangerous place to be a land defender. The Philippines is rated one of the deadliest countries in the world to be a land defender, and Bobby's chainsaw tree was a statement to everyone to say, hey, don't be afraid. We can stand up. We have to face this culture of fear and impunity and be brave. And so it was a pretty compelling way of sort of kernel for a documentary.
Yeah, it's a bit like seizing the means of production, or when, you know, police forces might crush a whole bunch of cars that have been hooned in. Seizing the actual device of the crime is pretty powerful, especially when you put it on display. So when it comes to the laws around logging in Palawan, how do they know how to get away with it? How is there not more enforcement from a state or a national perspective?
Well, I think a couple of the very powerful moments in the film is when Bobby and one of the chief para enforcers, Tata, you know, they sort of break down and they say, why are we doing this? Why are we being forced to do it? They're essentially volunteers going out and doing this, putting their own lives on the line, and their men have been murdered. And they say it is the government's responsibility. But they're essentially filling a vacuum because the authorities are not only not protecting the forest, but often authorities are in connivance with the business people, are doing the logging themselves. And so they're battling some very powerful forces.
I mean, your movie describes this region as one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a land defender. I mean, the risks are pretty high, as you experienced almost firsthand, in terms of the risk of death or injury when it comes to defending the land, as these people want to do.
Yes, one of the men that we hiked into the forest with and documented helping to confiscate a chainsaw or a couple of chainsaws. He was later murdered in the same area, trying to confiscate chainsaws. 13 of the PNNI team members have been murdered over the years. In 2019, the Global Witness, which an international NGO which documents the deaths of land defenders around the world, said that the Philippines was the deadliest country in the world to be a land defender. So if it's not, and if they're not the deadliest, they rank alongside, Brazil, Colombia, Honduras, and I guess in the Philippines, that's part of. It's not just dangerous to be a land defender; it's dangerous to stand up to almost any authority who is. It is a very corrupt country. So whether you're a journalist, whether you're a land defender, whether you're a judge, it can be very dangerous. I guess we all know about it's not just the death threat, the deaths or the murders. It's the intimidation. We all know about Maria Ressa, the journalist who won the Nobel Peace Prize for her incredible bravery to stand up to authorities. And Maria Ressa is just one part of a huge network of incredibly brave people who are standing up to corrupt interests in the Philippines.
Yeah, dangerous to stand up to these corrupt influences. Also dangerous to make a documentary about the people standing up to these corrupt influences. I want to ask you about how your collaboration with the PNNI worked during this film. I mean, there's footage of the raids they do. You went into the field with them. How dangerous was it in documenting their story?
There were risks, but they were certainly manageable. One of the key things was it was essentially myself and our director of photography, Tom Bannigan, an incredible cinematographer, an Australian cinematographer.
I know Tom. He is really a very, very, very talented man.
He certainly is, and he's tough as nails. So going to the forest with Tom, you always felt a bit stronger. And also, going into the forest with them, they were led by this incredible leader, Tata Baladaras. And Tata is an ex-militia member. In the Philippines, there are these militias who work for essentially the government. And so he has this military training and this military background. He was an ex-logger himself, so his story of written, and he left that life to essentially flip sides. And his story of redemption is incredibly powerful in the film. But it was also when you're in the forest and he's leading and Tata's giving his hand signals and you see the confidence that his men have with him, that gave us a lot of confidence as well. And it wasn't, I guess, just the dangers of being in the forest. The other, one of the other main participants in the film is an environmental campaigner turned politician, and her name is Nieves Rosento. And we met Nieves at the funeral for one of the parent forces who was murdered. She was a good friend of his. And Nieves was taking on powerful interests in Palawan in a different manner, in the political arena. And for that, she was put on then President Rodrigo Duterte's drug list. That drug war has left thousands of people dead. And she was essentially awaiting assassination after being put on that drug list, after being named personally by the president on TV. So we were following her for quite a long time, and she certainly felt that her life was in danger.
On ABCRN, I'm Andy Park. Carl Malanikunas is my guest in the drawing room. We're talking about the land defenders of Palawan and his documentary Delicado. Just turning back to that political picture, the story behind the logging in terms of the power struggles, if you like. I mean, I had the misfortune of meeting one of the last governors of Palawan, Abraham Mitra, and his security patrol one time I was in Palawan. But who is the current governor, Jose Alvarez? And he wouldn't speak to you, would he? And what did you find out about him?
So, Governor Alvarez, he was a logger himself. When logging concessions were legal in the Philippines during the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos and the years shortly after, Jose Alvarez had the logging concessions in Palawan. After that, he has continued to be a very powerful business and political figure on the island and nationally. At one point during the time of our making of the film, he was officially listed as the richest elected official in the Philippines, whether that's at a provincial or national level. And so he's a very powerful businessman and a very powerful politician. Bobby Chan will say that as governor, he has been responsible for some of the illegal logging that's been going on. Undoubtedly, the province is being developed. There's a lot of mining going on. There is a lot of forest being cleared for plantations. And In Bobby's eyes, Governor Alvarez is one of the one of the principal figures in the destruction of the island. And yes, we did try to speak to Governor Alvarez, and he didn't grant us an interview. We do access some archive footage where he talks, quite openly about his vision for Palawan, and that's to develop the last frontier. That's to turn it into a bustling part of the greater Philippine economy.
There is quite an interesting irony or contradiction in your film, in the sense that the men of the PNNI show a lot of concern for the people that they arrest. I mean, they know that they're often doing this out of desperation and out of poverty. That must make things quite complicated for them.
I guess yes and no. It makes it, when they approach the loggers or the fishermen. One of the most powerful parts of the making of the film for me was to see the empathy that they had for the people that they were confiscating the chainsaws or the boats from. There's one moment in the film where the guys confront an illegal logger, and we see both of their feet on the log that's been cut down, and both of them are in flip-flops, and their toes are just like, they just show this hard living of being out in the land, without being able to afford shoes. And both of them are like that. And so they come from that place of understanding. And I think that actually helps in surviving there, because they don't actually generally attract the people that they're confiscating from don't generally become enemies. There's this sort of tacit understanding. It's when, I guess, the loggers come out of the forest and they go to their boss and they say, "Hey, boss, we've lost our chainsaw." It's the people above that. It's the people who are organising the logging that then are the threats to the parent forces. But actually, amongst the community, there's a lot of support for the parent forces, because they all live amongst each other.
There's this sort of religious impulse behind the work for Bobby and his men, which brings another layer when it comes to, I suppose, what they can excuse in their mission to save these last remaining tracts of rainforest. Does that help them deal with the risks that they're taking, do you think, that righteousness, if you like?
It certainly does. Yeah. Yes. Bobby takes a lot of guidance and solace from his firm convictions. He comes from a Jesuit background, and that very much drives him. But throughout, the Philippines is obviously a predominantly Catholic country, and the parent forces that we with hold these their firm convictions as well. The film opens up with the guy sitting in the forest, eating some steamed rice and some canned food, and about to go out on a mission, and they pray together, and it's very much a source of comfort and a source of strength for all of them.
Since your documentary concluded filming in the field, there has been a lot of change in the Philippines more broadly. Rosento lost re-election as the mayor of El Nido. Duterte stepped down. Those are two huge shifts. How do you think that will affect the mission for these land defenders?
Well, yes, and in actual fact, Governor Alvarez, he was required under the Constitution to relinquish the governorship. There was he was term limited; he could serve three terms as governor. So he had to stand down as governor, but he has flipped over to win a national Congress seat. So he remains a very, very powerful figure in Palawan. Nieves Rosento did lose the election back in 2019. We just had these recent elections in May of this year. She after all the threats, after all the hardships, she says, "I'm going to come back." You know, she says in the movie, "I'm going to fight back. I'm not giving up." And she won a provincial seat in at the last election. So she's fought back.
Yeah, great.
The Paran forces. You know, if people are interested, they can go onto the PNNI's Facebook page, and you can still see these guys. You know, they don't have very much money. It's poverty. Is one of their biggest opponents. And you can, throughout the pandemic, when even money's even been harder to come by, they've continued to go out on their confiscation missions. In fact, just their most recent post from a few days ago, they've gone out and to the mountains around, you know, this beautiful tourist town of El Nido, and again, extracted another chainsaw. So they're still fighting, they're still battling against the odds. In regards to the national level, yes, you know, President, or then President Duterte has stood down again after being, he can only serve a single 6-year term. So Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the son of the dictator, has won, and Rodrigo Duterte's daughter, Sara, has become vice president. So these forces, you know, what the rights groups would say, that the forces that allow this culture of impunity to exist in the Philippines has just deepened. It's gone another step, and so the battle continues. But essentially, Nieves Rezende, Bobby Chan, the Paran forces, they haven't given up. They're continuing to fight.
Well, Kyle, it's a fantastic documentary. Congratulations on this work, and thank you so much for being my guest here in The Drawing Room.
Oh, thanks very much. It was great to be here.
Kyle Malakounas has been my guest in The Drawing Room. His documentary, Delicado, is screening as part of the Melbourne International Film Festival. That's all for the show tonight. I'm Andy Park. I'll be back tomorrow from 6. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.